Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
By the way, our online video picks for this week are up on our website, including Hillary Clinton's funny video on how to vote in the Iowa caucuses, compared with Barack Obama's earnest one, plus Apple's unusual iPod commercial. They say you might get mugged if you have one. I guess that's a good thing. Our online video picks at WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Now, every week this month, we're checking in with personal finance expert Alvin Hall about how to account for your money before the end of the year. Alvin lives here in New York and also consults financial institutions. He's the author of You and Your Money, It's More Than Just Numbers. And hi, Alvin. Welcome back to WNYC.
Good morning, Brian. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. And listeners, you can call in with your end-of-year money questions at 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Alvin, last week you were beginning to talk about an end-of-the-year personal audit.
Yes.
Tell me more about that. Is this to see if you're living beyond your means this year?
Yes, it's designed to see if you have been living beyond your means, but also it gives you a sense of the good things and the bad things you did in the previous year. So it looks back and it says, okay, what did I do that increased my wealth, and what did I do that set me back? By doing that, you then learn from your past mistakes and give yourself the ability to correct those and move forward in the new year.
What are some of the most common, shocking discoveries that people make when they audit themselves?
That's a good question. One of the big ones is that they look in their closets and they discover they bought all of these clothes that they have not worn that are just sitting there, you know, gathering dust instead of the money earning interest. They also find out that sometimes they let little things slip through the cracks. For example, if they have one of those situations where they pay for certain types of health care coverage in advance, such as for eyeglasses or dental work, they may have forgotten that money and it drifts away. Another thing people always forget are their frequent flyer miles. So if they have a frequent flyer account, they just let the miles drift away. By sitting down, making a list of everything that you need to check, and then checking it before the end of the year, you can correct some of those traditional mistakes.
So to have a list of the common things. How about unredeemed gift cards?
Oh, yes. I'm guilty of that one, Brian.
You know, I wasn't here last week, but you mentioned with guest host David Cruz the shirts also. Do you think overspending on clothing is one of the most common things people do?
Yes, overspending on clothing and food are the most common things. People go to stores, especially right after Christmas, and you'll see all of your favorite shirts on sale, and you'll buy them in every color when you're not going to really wear them in every color.
What do you mean overspending on food?
Well, in this case, when people go shopping, it's surprising to me over the 5 years I did a program in Britain called Your Money or Your Life, we would audit people's refrigerators and then ask them how much food they throw away at the end of every week. We found that people threw away 10 to 20% of the food they bought. So all of that money is being thrown away.
Wow.
So what we did, we had people make a budget, make a list before they went shopping. We also tried to alter their shopping patterns so they would not buy lots of pre-prepared food to order in all the time, but buy things that were simple to prepare in order to save money. It's shocking how much food people throw away.
Listeners, questions for Alvin Hall on the phone or on our comments page, 212-433-WNYC. He's here for you, usually Thursdays this month, but this week it's today, Friday, 212-433-9692, or post a comment or question to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. I guess people should do this audit before they do all their Christmas shopping.
It would help. I tell everyone they should start this audit around December, because as you are beginning your Christmas shopping, because most people do save it until the last minute, you then get a sense of the things you own that you could probably share with others. I'm not a fan of necessarily regifting, but I am a fan of looking at what you own, and if a relative has said to you, listen, I really wish I had that. If I could find that, I'd buy it. Why not? If you haven't used it, give it away. A friend of mine recently talked about a pair of cufflinks that I had, and they were by some Danish designer. I'd bought them many years ago.
Uh-huh.
And every time I would wear them, he said, God, I wish I had them. God, I wish I had them. Well, this year, for his Christmas present, I decided to give them to him. And he'll be thrilled to have them. It's something I've had. I can now pass on to somebody else. They'll be thrilled with it, and I save money in the process.
And that's really beyond regifting. I don't know what's so bad about regifting anyway. If it's something that's new, that's somebody gave you that's perfectly good, but you don't want it. But you're even talking beyond that to take something that's not new, but that you think somebody else would appreciate as a gift more than you would use it.
Exactly, or something that you've used for years and it has a sentimental value for that person because it comes from you. It's a great thing to do for somebody. Another thing that a friend of mine does, she doesn't have a lot of money, so she makes cookies for everybody, little packs of cookies or little packs of candies every year. And it's become this tradition because she lives on a fixed income, and I think she's just near retirement right now, and she doesn't have a lot of money. She does that, and this helps her save money near the end of the year. I think people need to think out of the box. Stop looking at the word sale as being the only way you can get something. Think of something you can do on your own that costs less.
And, you know, we'll forget about the tie. We'll remember the cookies.
Exactly.
retailers, as we know, do a lot of their annual business at Christmas time.
Yes.
How much of total personal spending for the year does Christmas shopping account for the average American? Any idea?
I don't know the exact numbers, but taking a rough guess, I would say it's probably about 5 to 10%, because people tend to spend more at Christmas than any other time solely because it's the period of emotion-driven spending. And what's interesting is that people tend to view this time of year as being like some adventurer, you know, like Charles Darwin. They're going out into this unknown world of retail, and they're going to find that they're going to discover, the better word, they're going to discover that one perfect gift for this person that will say, I love you for generations to come. Well, we know that doesn't happen in reality, but people want that thrill. So one of the things they need to look at before they wade out into the sea of buying all of this stuff is, what are my priorities? What are the things that will make this person most happy? And you may be lucky enough to find it on sale. And if you do, don't buy anything else.
Alvin Hall, personal financial advice giver here on WNYC, author of You and Your Money, It's More Than Just Numbers, 212-433-WNYC. If you want to take advantage of his presence, 212-433-9692, or post to WNYC.org. Click on Brian Lehrer Show. Mary Beth in Red Bank, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi, Brian. Good morning.
Good morning.
My question is this, with your guest, I'm sorry, I don't remember his name.
Alvin Hall.
Oh, Alvin, I have a question for you. My husband and I have a fixed-rate mortgage, 30 years, and we have an option of paying interest only for 10 years. And what we've been doing for the past year is paying the interest only and taking the principal, which, if it were fully amortized, I think is like $300 a month. And we've been investing that money in a mutual fund with the thought that after the 10 years, we'll make a lump payment to the mortgage and then begin to pay off the regular, you know, fully amortized amount. Is that a smart thing to do?
It's clever, but it's very dangerous. You're going from a situation where you have a fixed rate mortgage, you know your payments every month, and you're investing in the stock market during a time when there's great volatility in the market. There is no guarantee that the market is going to go up. And I hope you and your husband sat down and had a big discussion about the consequences of this action. You didn't look at just the rosy side, i.e. we'll be able to pay it off, but you looked at the downside. What if the stock market did have a 10% pullback, a 20% pullback? Would you be able to pay off your mortgage and maintain your lifestyle? So you've done something that's clever, but if you haven't evaluated the risk associated with this, the downside risk, then you could be blindsided by this.
Mary Beth, thanks for your call. And, you know, it's funny that this comes up around interest and mortgages, because in the news right now is, of course, the credit crunch.
Yes.
And the Federal Reserve Board just lowered interest rates and then took a separate other step this week to infuse cash into the financial system to make sure credit is available. And I wonder if you can just take a minute and explain that second action, because I'm sure it's hard for many people to imagine that Citibank or Chase or whatever their local lending institution is would actually be short of cash for loans, that they would need an infusion from the government. What's the story?
These institutions have been hit with such huge losses that the losses have to be netted out against certain other assets that they have. That means that in order to maintain their status as a bank, they don't have as much cash available, because you have to net out some of those losses against other assets that you own. As a result, they don't have as much free cash floating around as you would think. So therefore, in order to keep the market liquid, to keep the dollar, if you will, moving through the economy at a decent rate, there had to be an injection of other capital in the market. These institutions have been hit really hard, and a lot harder than they were willing to admit at first. So for the average person, if you're out there trying to take out a loan at the moment, trying to get credit, you may find that the credit evaluation process is much more stringent now. And when a couple of months ago, with a not-so-good credit rating, you might have been able to get a credit card or a loan, you might not be able to get that now.
So you're saying because of the bank's bad loans on subprime mortgages, it is less possible now to get loans that you're actually qualified for.
Absolutely. And it's not just the bank's loans on subprime mortgages. I think it's actually more complex than that.
Uh-huh.
What the banks did, they bought some of the products themselves. So the mortgages were put into the pools, and then they created these other products off of those mortgages. And some of the banks invested in those products. In some cases, they weren't able to sell those products that they created from the mortgage pool onto others. So they were still sitting on their books. So when the mortgage crisis started, they not only had mortgages in which they had invested sitting on their books, they had mortgages that they couldn't sell on to other people still sitting on their books. So it was a double whammy, in essence.
Tony in Manhattan, you're on WNYC with Alvin Hall. Hi, Tony.
Hi.
Hi, Tony.
Yes. My question is, I plan to purchase a home. Now,
yes.
I took some money from my IRA, but I'm a bit nervous that the closing may not happen before the year ends, even though I was promised that it should happen. Now, I would like to know if I would be charged, if I'd be penalized for that early withdrawal from the 401k if the sale does not go through before the end of the year.
Well, it depends upon the terms of your 401k program. Depending upon where the institution with which you carry the program, some of them will let you withdraw money or take a loan, more accurately. They let you take a loan against your IRA as a first-time home buyer. However, if you have withdrawn that money from your IRA, and I use the word withdraw, in order to make a house payment, in order to buy a house, then you have set yourself up for taxation because you violated the terms of that and you're going to have to pay it. So check with your institution. See if, indeed, they had that clause that permitted you to take a loan as opposed to withdraw it.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
It's very clear about that. This is a mistake that a lot of first-time home buyers make. They have money sitting in a 401k program, and the money has gone up in value. They're desperate to buy a home. And rather than ask, they just assume that they can take that money out, use it to buy a home, and there'll be no tax consequences. No, no, no. Once you withdraw money from that program, it will be subject to typically a penalty, 10%, and it will be subject to normal taxation.
And it's so unfair when you're told that the closing is going to happen before the end of the year, and if there are different tax consequences for you because the bank or the seller or whatever can't get it together until January 2nd, that's just a darn shame.
Exactly, but that's part of the risk of taking out mortgages. I think people often think that these things are like clockwork. You know, you can say it's going to happen 1, 2, 3, 4. You need to always build in contingency in these situations because nothing ever happens. It's like renovating a house. I'm sure, Brian, you've gone through a home renovation, and the builder says, I can do this in 6 months. 9 months later, you're still going through it with your punch list. Nothing happens on time.
Luckily, I've never gone through that one. Helen in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Helen.
Hi. I would like to know if your guest thinks that since the banks, some of the banks, are short in cash for loans, whether the interest rates on CDs, which you would give to the bank, the money that you would give to the bank, could be considered would be coming up and be higher.
Oh, well, in other words, will CD rates go up because the banks are more desperate for our money? People don't realize, Alvin, that when we deposit money in a bank or buy a CD, we're loaning money to the bank.
Absolutely. And chances are the rates will stay the same or get better as they are desperate for money.
Really?
Yes, because...
So even as the Fed is lowering interest rates, you're saying interest rates for consumers making deposits could go up.
They may stay the same as they are now or go up a little bit because the banks want your money. They need the money. So if you have money and you're willing to loan it to one of these banks in the form of a CD, they may be paying you. They may be willing to pay you a little bit more.
Yeah.
It's not a guarantee.
Yeah.
And I haven't checked the interest rates really to see if they're going down right now. But my guess is when you're this desperate for money that you need these huge cash infusions, anyone sitting on cash is sort of in the catbird
yeah.
seat.
You can get a CD for
you can make money from your money.
Short-term CD for around 5%.
Exactly.
Should people consider, here's an explosive question.
Yes.
Should people consider taking their money out of banks if banks are at risk of insolvency right now?
Well, thank goodness in the U.S. we do have the Federal Reserve policy, and the reserves are guaranteed by the FDIC.
Is it up to $100,000?
It's up to $100,000.
So this is a banking 101 thing. If you
yes.
have more than $100,000 in any commercial bank, you should move it around, move that excess out to another bank. Is that correct?
You know, that is a really interesting question, Brian. And here's my answer for that question. One, if you have most banks in the U.S. are pretty solvent banks. So your money is reasonably secure at almost any of the major money center banks. However, if you are concerned that your bank is in trouble and you're worried that they may go bankrupt, it may pay to spread it around. But I don't think people should do this in sort of a panic mode.
Yeah.
Because
well, not in panic mode,
are,
but, right, but you say
solvent.
Most banks. How do we know? We're not looking at the bank. You know, how do we know if Citibank or Apple Bank or Chase or whatever is the good one and Countrywide is the bad one? Countrywide's been in the headline, so people might be, you know, more suspicious of them. But
I don't think the U.S. is going to let a big money center bank like a Bank America or Chase or a Citibank go bankrupt so easily. Can you imagine what that would do to the confidence in the U.S. economy?
I did see a headline this morning that Citigroup is infusing cash to bail out 7 of its funds
yes.
that are being hammered because of the subprime loan crisis.
Yes, yes, and they have to do that in order to save the investors who have that money into the funds. That's a different issue for me. I often think that if you've had those funds and you put money into them, investing involves some risk. And so Citibank is really trying to save its reputation as, you know, as a place of for people to make investments by doing this. But it still means the bank is in trouble. And most of us forget when they made the loans to the Latin American countries many years ago. I think the Citibank stock dropped somewhere around, it was below $10 at one point. And the government, again, helped bail them out.
Huh.
So I think the government will probably not let these banks fail. It would be really devastating if they did.
I'm changing my name to Chrysler, as someone once said. Suzanne in Brooklyn Heights are on WNYC. Hi, Suzanne.
Hello. Good morning.
Good morning, Suzanne.
So?
Alvin, can I say I was a great fan of your show when I lived in England?
Oh, thank you very much. Thank you. I appreciate that.
My question is that you mentioned that we throw away food, that we
yes.
are very happy to go and have takeout and to eat out. And I just wonder what's changed between me and my grandma's generation. Why do I think it's a pain to think about my week ahead and to budget the food?
I think it's because our lives are actually much busier. We have so many different things, going out to pick up the kids, meeting with friends. In the old days, and I grew up in those old days, life was a lot simpler. We didn't have all those distractions, those things pulling at us. So we view things like food and stuff like that as being things we should be able to do quickly to get to handle it fast, to move on to the next task at hand. And I think we all need to sit down and slow down a bit and think to ourselves, okay, what things are important to us? I'm a really big fan of cooking every single day I can, actually. I eat out 2 nights a week, but 5 nights a week I actually try to stay at home and make dinner. I may have a friend or two in to have a nice conversation over a meal, but I have decided to make that a priority in my life. I think that's what people need to do.
Suzanne,
okay, thank
thanks
you.
For your call.
Thank you, Suzanne. Thank you for the comments also.
Alvin Hall, obviously a transcontinental media star, financial expert who had a show in Britain, and he's joining us once a week through December to talk about end-of-the-year money questions, and unfortunately we're out of time for today. Alvin is also the author of the book, You and Your Money, It's More Than Just Numbers. So, Alvin, thanks for all the advice, and we'll
thank
talk to you next Thursday.
And I'll see you in the studio next Thursday.
That's great. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Don't forget to sign up for our free daily podcast. Every day we pick one segment from the program for your iPod or MP3. To sign up for that free daily podcast, just go to WNYC.org and click on Brian Lehrer Show.